are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Gun Violence Awareness Day. Tomorrow, in honor of National Gun Violence Awareness Day and the start of Wear Orange Weekend, people around the country are coming together with a simple message. There's more we can do to end gun violence. Each year, Every Town for Gun Safety and a broad coalition of partners call on Americans to wear orange and recognize the more than 90 lives cut short by gun violence every day and demand action toward a future free from gun violence. Join the movement by wearing orange tomorrow, June 1st, and post your picture online using the hashtag WearOrange to show you're committed to ending gun violence.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 31st, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eric Levitz. He's an assistant editor and writer for New York Magazine. We're talking about why unions are good. More research demonstrating what everybody should already know and the political solutions necessary for a democratic future, plus the real estimate of the death toll in Puerto Rico. And shockingly, Purdue, the drug company, they knew about opioid issues going back to the 1990s. Shocking. Who'd have thunk it? Also, Donald Trump is bragging about the economy and going to have fun on a trip to talk to the victims of mass shootings on the West Coast. That's an interesting use of the word fun.
It's going to be great.
Brazil's imprisoned political prisoner, former President Lula, still maintains a lead in that country's presidential elections. The Virginia General Assembly approves a Medicaid expansion that will cover 400,000 low-income residents. Top North Korean officials are set to meet with their American counterparts. And why new statistics show that the government is keeping more, quote-unquote, lost migrant children than had previously been disclosed. Trump is remaking federal policy with regards to women's reproductive justice, even as Ireland moves forward in a historic repeal of that country's criminalization of reproductive rights. The Federal Reserve votes to ease a rule aimed at preventing big banks from making risky financial bets. That always works out well. And the new NSC chief of staff is from a group that believes that Muslims are plotting to take over the United States. How did they find out? That's what I want to know.
Best people.
As a Muslim. Trump plans to impose metal tariffs on some of our closest allies. And Italy's political crisis, a gut punch for the Eurozone project. Plus, Texas governor lays out school safety plans in the wake of the Santa Fe shooting. Of course, none of those plans have anything to do with, you know, like getting guns out of potential school shooters' hands, obviously. Probably just more securitized, criminalized schools. What's up, everybody? We're all here except for the four-day-a-week man. The whole crew on target.
Be nice if there was a stop, drop, and roll for school shootings.
Right. That's what we need. That's the type of solution-oriented, non-ideological thinking that we need to really take on problems, Matt. And I appreciate you finally bringing that to this show, because this show is very ideological. I like how somebody said the other day, oh man, I forget where, on Twitter or something, they were like, you guys like attack Elon Musk, Jordan Peterson, and Sam Harris. You're like anti-YouTube. I was like, yeah. It's true. Takes a lot of brass to attack a histrionic, insane, self-help fascist, whiny, atheistic, racist, and a glorified government contractor who wants to threaten the free press. That's what we do every single day on this show.
We're reappropriating YouTube.
Hell yeah. Donald Trump is reappropriating the presidency, and here he is at a tarmac. He's getting ready to go on a trip, I believe, is it to Texas, to speak to people who are the victims of a recent school shooting. And check out, there's a lot going on in this clip. First, though, is he finally, I mean, he's never going to be bored of bragging, period, but he's definitely getting bored of bragging about how much he's crushing the economy.
And he's actually making some comments. Let's listen.
Seeing what's in the letter, but it's very important to them. So they'll be probably coming down to Washington, D.C. on Friday for the delivery of a letter. I look forward to that. Other than that, the economy is good. Stock market's up. A lot of jobs. Best unemployment we've had in many, many decades, actually. And we're going to Dallas. We're going to Houston. And we're going to have a little fun today. Thank you very much.
So basically, he just was like, yeah, whatever. More people have boring jobs with bosses who apparently actually pay their paychecks. Whatever. I'm crushing it. I'm getting bored of talking about the economy. And then we're going to go speak to some people who are just victims of school shootings where we'll have some fun.
That's kind of like when your mom asks He's you how school life. Was, and you're like, it's fine, it's good.
It's like, I've been getting many, many A's. It's been great. The teachers love me. There's been a lot of A's. And
what'd you do at the sleepover? Played.
Played. Had fun. We played video games. It was great. We're moving forward. I think we will have many more sleepovers. Now, if I go to my room and masturbate, thank you.
How many times do you think he's going to brag about winning the election in his tour of shooting victims?
Yeah. You know, tough things happen. Like your friends get shot, and I thought we were going to lose. And then we won. By the way, here's a map. It'll help cheer you up. shows kids just survive.
Like, his electoral. Tough, but this will calm you down. Look at this map. Yeah. It calms me down.
Look at this map.
He's literally going to do that.
It's self-soothing. Does everybody want to share in a self-soothe? Now I realize that not everybody has a daughter like Ivanka. So. No, you don't have daughters yet. Maybe you will. That is, we got to do just a brief like, yeah, whatever. The economy's crushing it. A lot of devils and new jobs, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, we're going to go off and talk to some kids who got shot. Have some fun. Later.
Newtown, maybe get some ice cream.
Yeah, we'll go to Newtown. It's fun. It's a cute little Connecticut town. I didn't realize how robust downtown was over there. So, yeah, we'll have some fun. And, yeah, a lot of new jobs, whatever.
Maybe someday you'll have a daughter as hot as Malia.
See the way she's aging? Come on, man. Let's be real. Or it could be like now. It's like, yeah. Democracy's coming apart, it seems. My signature achievements are getting chipped away at every day, but Netflix deal.
Holla. The truth.
Yeah, that is. It isn't far from the truth, but I don't. What is he supposed like?
No, I agree with
if that. He was injecting himself, it would only like what Obama's meticulous. Like he's gonna by the time Obama fully relaunches his national presence with like we're better than that speeches. Even like some of the most hardened, most despicable people in the country are just going to be like, you know, I kind of miss that black guy. Like he's just going to time it so perfectly that by the time he's like in the 2020 campaign stretch being like, got to get out of the ditch, everybody, because we're all Americans. People like it's going to be like Stormfront guys being like, you know, the things just felt a little bit calmer when he was president. All right, guys, we're going to take a brief break. But before that, I got to tell you once again. Sorry, what was that? Today's show is brought to you by Gun Violence Awareness Day. Tomorrow, in honor of Gun Violence Awareness Day and the start of Wear Orange Weekend, people around the country are coming together with a simple message. There's more we can do to end gun violence. Show your support by wearing orange and posting a picture using the hashtag WearOrange. Orange is the defining color of the gun violence prevention movement. And each year, every town for gun safety and a broad coalition of partners call on Americans to wear orange for National Gun Violence Awareness Day and recognize the more than 90 lives cut short and hundreds wounded by gun violence every day, and to demand action toward a future free from gun violence. Join the movement by wearing orange tomorrow, June 1st. And don't forget to post your pictures using the hashtag WearOrange to show the world you're committed to ending gun violence in every community. You can also go to every town's website, www.wearorange.org, to find an event for Wear Orange Weekend of Action. Together we can stand up, speak out, and wear orange to raise awareness about gun violence. We will be right back with Eric Levitz on the Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Eric Levitz. He's a political writer for New York Magazine's Intelligencer. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Eric, you have a new piece out. Unions are not a special interest group. And you go over recent research on how unions are really essential for all the things that I think, you know, those of us who sort of pay some attention to these things already have a sense of, you know, raising wages, improving benefits, job security, and also that they have a disproportionate benefit for people of color and for women. But I really like the frame of that because there is this incredible false equivalency of talking about labor action as being analogous to, you know, corporate special interests or other narrow areas. Can you explain why you would not consider unions to be a special interest group?
Yeah, sure. So basically, you know, individual unions can at times be a special interest group in the sense that they have interests that are, you know, conflicting with the general public or the broader good. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a police union that is trying to protect its members from accountability when they shoot criminal suspects or just any random African-American. That's obviously a situation where the union is against the general public, and similarly, you know, more sympathetically with coal miners who are trying to defend their industry that fundamentally needs to go, or to, you know, shrink massively quickly. You know, they are in tension. But labor, organized labor as an institution more broadly, you know, and the reforms that it wants, which apply to all unions, in that capacity, they are not a special interest group, because we have reams and reams of research to suggest that their interests ultimately are the average ordinary worker's interest, whether that worker is in a union or not. We now have lots of research demonstrating that, you know, the private sector unionization rate in the United States negatively correlates with inequality and positively correlates with labor's share of productivity, that when the union private sector unionization rate is high, wages are higher for workers, whether they are unionized or not. And then, you know, another wrinkle on this that this new study was able to really put some light on was there was kind of this idea that unions, while they were, you know, good for workers who were in them, that workers who most benefited from unions tended to be higher skilled and tended to be more white. And so it was kind of shifting. What unions were really doing was redistributing wealth among workers, and actually in a regressive way, from more vulnerable workers to less vulnerable workers. And the study blows that up, one, by demonstrating that it was lifting wages for all workers, but secondly, by showing that when unions were at their peak, actually they were disproportionately African-American and disproportionately low-skilled. And the benefits that they provided to African-Americans were greater than whites. You know, unions fundamentally work as a way of insulating individual workers from abuse by their employers. And because African Americans in the mid-century United States were so vulnerable to abuse by their employers, the wage premium that they enjoyed when they had a union was larger than for any other group.
You also talked, there's also myth-busting here on higher unionization rate did not correlate with slower economic growth under any of the models that researchers applied.
Yeah. I mean, you know, is it possible theoretically that under some circumstances that unions may have a slight negative effect on growth? That, you know, maybe, but growth, you know, growth matters to the extent that it actually, the gains of growth are going to ordinary people and not just collecting in Jeff Bezos's bank account. And so it is pretty clear that if there is a negative effect on growth, it is not substantial enough to offset the gains in equity that unions have produced.
I mean, you know, as I say, I think like research like this is obviously very important. It confirms a lot of, you know, what you probably would know if you were attuned to a couple of basic sort of historical or policy questions and awareness of, you know, just some sort of very basic facts about power, about the economy, about how things like everything from a minimum wage to the weekend to the elimination of child labor were, you know, achieved. They weren't magically bestowed by, you know, generous corporate sector. They were earned through, you know, literal assertion of power in the labor sector. But, you know, unions seem like it's one of those areas where the mythology is so deep around them. And the fight against them has taken, you know, so many fronts since the sort of backlash starting in the 70s and obviously accelerated and deepened from the 80s through the present. On everything from, you know, state attacks on public sector unions to the, you know, devastation of private sector unions across the country. And there still seems to be a lot of sort of public propaganda that, you know, the union isn't the one that ensured that we don't live in sort of like a, you know, I don't know, Blade Runner society or whatever, and we kind of do, but that it's really like, oh, you know, those are the guys who stand on the road and, you know, collect money for no-show jobs and then, like, you know, insert mafia joke here. So how important do you think is this research with like the kind of broader just sort of communications war? Because so much of the attack on unions is like a combination of raw power moving against unions and just like incessant and relentless propaganda.
Yeah, I think that unions, the public perception of them and the perception of them within the Democratic Party has really shifted in recent years. You know, I mean, fundamentally, to the extent that there was any kind of popular backlash against unions, it was rooted in the experience of the 70s where you had unions who had contracts where their wages were tied to increases in inflation. So workers who were in unions were insulated from inflation, and workers who were outside of it, arguably the union contracts, were driving up prices even worse for them. And so there was actually some like basis for resenting unions in that peculiar economic circumstance. Mm-hmm. In today's circumstances, where you have massive inequality that is hurting all workers and unions are virtually powerless, there's no real case to be made that unions should not be aided, or that the average worker does not have anything that the average worker is being disadvantaged by the unions, and that the average worker would not benefit from their expansion. And so you see, you know, with every leading Democratic candidate endorsing very aggressive labor law reforms. So there is an ideological turn. The question is, in the fundamental problem for labor has been, to a large extent, the U.S. Senate, the fact that labor did not expand into the South. It did not get too far into the West in terms of the private sector. And so you have a lot of senators, Democratic senators, even if you get rid of the filibuster, I have only 51 votes. You have a lot of senators who come from states that don't have a strong labor movement, but every single business in that state that they're accountable to does not want progressive labor law. And so they have, there's no interest to counterbalance, like all of the businesses that fund them. Every industry doesn't want this, and you have no labor movement countering that. And that is why labor law reform keeps dying in the Senate under multiple Democratic administrations. Now, you know, it's so in the party's long-term interest, so in the nation's interest, that you would hope you could just elect a senator who does the right thing regardless of the internal pressures. But this is a problem that they've had previously, and I don't know whether or not it's going to take a lot of activism in organizing to overcome that problem should Democrats take that power.
Well, I'm wondering on two different threads here. And I mean, on one hand, adding further pressure, obviously, are things like the Janus case that's coming, recent, you know, rulings by the Supreme Court that have been, you know, even more significant structural attacks on labor. But then on the other hand, and obviously we've talked about and celebrated, you know, the teacher strikes, and they are happening in red states. Does that potentially start to actually both of those things in different ways potentially start to change that political calculus, you think?
Yeah, I really don't know. I hope so. You know, I think that the teacher strikes, I see that as most immediately, you know, really challenging the GOP's fiscal regime on the state level, you know, where you've got this somewhat untenable situation where the average Republican voter fundamentally does not support the fiscal priorities of the people that they elect. And so long as, you know, the cultural resentments and the partisan identification is so strong in a lot of these red states, that doesn't, so long as, you know, nobody within the party makes that a problem, it's not a problem. But you're starting to see with these teacher strikes, there are some, you know, self-identified conservative teachers out in these picket lines. And in Kentucky, last week or the week before, you had a GOP primary where a protege of Mitch McConnell, who is the House Majority Leader in Kentucky, lost a primary to a teacher who was, you know, making the incumbent support for pension cuts and education cuts a major issue in the campaign. So I see some promise in terms of reforming the politics of these red states, and maybe that carries over into support for unions more broadly, but we'll have to see.
Let's just touch, we're going to get to Puerto Rico in a second, but let's actually just touch briefly on, you wrote a very good piece on one of the, you know, one of the main enemies of this show, and one of the main gurus of YouTube, Jordan Peterson, and you focus specifically on this talk of equality of opportunity versus outcome. Now, I have a lot of problems with that generally, because that's, it doesn't really mean anything when you drill down into it. And I think you can't really ensure certain equality of opportunity without certain equalities of outcome, frankly. But that being said, I mean, you did a great job, and please elaborate on sort of, you know, debunking the idea that we're in some type of collectivist moment. Obviously, that's just insane from a, you know, a policy and reality and political perspective. But what do you make of, you know, we spend so much time on the cultural resentments and the sort of contradictory politics that you just identified in the red states that motivate some of the Republican base. I think there's an overlap, but the Jordan Peterson kind of audience is a bit different. There's a certain affluence to it, maybe. There's a certain self-helpedness to it. I guess maybe debunk his argument, but also, like, why is it, do you think, that especially a time like this, when nothing could be further from the truth, that this argument is so resonant?
Yeah, well, I mean, Jordan Peterson is a complicated phenomenon, and I don't want to speak to all of it, because a lot of different issues are wrapped up in that. But I do think that
emphasis on the word issues. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. This particular aspect of his thought, in the way that it's echoed by, you know, people like Joe Rogan, Ben Shapiro, the intellectual dark web, you know, the existence of that term in our discourse, to me, I think that all reflects the fact that, you know, right of center intellectuals in the Trump era have a much easier time critiquing the extremely online left or than actually, like, defending what's actually going on in the political economy and in the Trump administration. And right. They don't really have an argument for policies, but they do have some left-wing people who annoy them on Twitter, and they blow this up into, like, a totalitarian ideology that they are bravely condemning every other week or every other day in the New York Times.
Minute, yeah.
And so I think that's the Peterson's thing, is shtick is a part of that. But the argument of my piece is that Peterson, a lot of other people, they have this whole thing about railing against equality of outcome, and which is really a bizarre thing to spend your time arguing against at a time when American America's economy is like at Gilded Age levels of inequality. The average CEO makes like 144 times the average worker. Black households have 12 times more wealth than the median black household, et cetera. But where it comes from is that there is this sort of pedantry about the gender wage gap. So progressives online will, you know, present disparities, racial gender disparities, and present them as though they are tantamount to evidence of social injustice. And there's this resentment, you know, connected to like the James Damore thing. And from this segment of right-leaning men who, right-leaning STEM sort of men who are like, you know, it's a fallacy to suggest that just because there aren't as many female engineers as male engineers, that this means that there is a gender discrimination. Like, people can just have differences. There are biological differences between the sexes. You know, the average man is taller than the average woman. Why couldn't the average man be more interested in engineering than the average woman? And from this, they extrapolate that the left isn't just interested in lessening gender inequalities in pay, but that actually they're philosophically, they believe in equal outcomes, and they are committed to this totalitarian Marxist ideal of everybody in a just society would have exactly the same skills and qualities and money, which is, you know, totally baseless. What I point out in the article is that fundamentally this isn't an argument about equality of outcomes. I don't actually know any feminists who believe that as soon as we get rid of the patriarchy, there will be women starting at middle linebacker in the NFL. And I don't actually even know that many socialists who literally believe that after the revolution, we should have everybody having the exact same material goods. Most, I think, tend to believe that you need some sort of incentive structure to reward the people who, you know, someone's got to clean the toilets after the revolution, and they better get rewarded, you know, disproportionately from the people who are, you know, whatever, podcasting.
Know, Eric, there is another scenario about who cleans the toilets after the revolution, and there's some sort of, yeah, slightly, I don't want to elaborate on that. I'll save that for my other show. Go ahead.
But the argument is really about quality of opportunity, and what the, you know, most progressives are doing when they, you know, suggest that the gender pay gap obviously reflects institutional sexism is they aren't necessarily saying that, like, in a perfect world, you know, there would be exactly 50% male, 50% female in mechanical engineering or whatever, but that there are demonstrable biases throughout our society. You know, we're living in a culture that until 1993, you know, it was constitutionally allowed and it was legal in multiple states for men to rape their wives. They could not be prosecuted for that because once entering the marriage contract, they had full reign to their wives' body.
Right.
So, you know, this is where we live, you know, and there's plenty of empirical research demonstrating the way that the legacy of patriarchy affects and pervades, you know, relations in the workplace, the, you know, basic stuff like how, you know, men will perceive that women are dominating a conversation when they're actually talking less than they are. Lots of stuff like this. And then, of course, there's the whole fundamental inequities in our system of, you know, social reproduction, the amount of reproductive labor that women do in terms of housework, childcare that goes uncompensated, and that it's assumed that they will take care of, and that our entire economy relies on them performing that uncompensated work, et cetera. So, you know, the situation is even more stark with race, which they, translated over to. But, you know, I mean, it just
right.
kind of sort of
right. Yeah, race is the next, and that's when you need to start bringing back, you know, social Darwinism and pseudoscience. But I think that there's two just points I just want to button on that briefly. I mean, one that's I think is actually really interesting is I think in some ways you could almost actually, you know, really flip the tables on, you know, especially, you know, the sort of obsession with like kind of like gender orders and stuff like that, because you can actually say like, you know, we won't really have any idea what aspect of the conversation is actually about, you know, science or actual like gender differences until you've done so much work to overcome these biases, right? Like, if you actually had overcome all of this, and then people were sort of like, without all of these impediments, sort of like sorting themselves, then maybe we could actually make some very, very cautious claims that they want to claim now. But we simply are nowhere near an environment enough to even sort of like sketch the surface of, in terms of like, you know, why somebody becomes a mechanical engineer, as you said. I think the second point, though, is that I guess when I say like certain outcomes, it's, you know, need to be ensured. Like, you know, I mean, the sort of very obvious example, because a lot of times, at least when people get slightly concrete about equality of opportunity, and even these guys are not as direct on this either, but they'll say basically like, look, every single person needs to have access to a really high quality education. Well, then, okay, but if you don't equalize, as an example, the tax base, so, you know, tax funding is delinked from property taxes, and, you know, then that's not going to work. And then in addition to that, if, you know, two kids are going to school and they both have a great education, but one of them doesn't have food at home or healthcare, or their parents don't have healthcare, well, that's not going to work. So I think there are certain things that we could define as outcomes, like somebody never goes without food, healthcare, housing, you know, really basic stuff that we have to ensure before we could even properly use this equality of opportunity term to begin with, because, you know, it just sort of, it means nothing in the absence of those, you know, sort of basic and obvious things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's used to fundamentally just assert without an argument that, you know, if there isn't a jure discrimination, then you have equal opportunity. The Civil Rights Act passed, so stop complaining.
Right.
Which is, you know, I mean, even the most, like, even if you wanted to extract away all social conditions, like growing up in poverty, we have the science now. Exposure to lead pipes, exposure to insecurity in your family changes your cognitive ability immediately. So, and it changes your gene expression even. Yep. So like genetics cannot be separated from environment. Even that can't be. So you know, the most basic idea, you know, who you are is fundamentally determined by the distribution of resources in your society to a significant degree. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, these very scientific minded, right-wingers will not engage with.
You're a collectivist. Okay, let's talk about Puerto Rico. There's a new Harvard study, we mentioned this the other day on the show, that suggests that Hurricane Maria has killed thousands of Puerto Ricans. And, you know, in fact, I'll give the number specifically, 4,581. The official death toll still stands at 64. Now, I want you to explain this study in a second, and I'm asking this question not in any way. I mean, you know, I loathe this administration. Their response to Puerto Rico is as disgusting as you would expect. And U.S. policy, frankly, far beyond the Trump administration, is obviously colonial towards Puerto Rico. But, I mean, have they kept it at 64 because they're at least maybe even publicly making a claim that they're, you know, waiting to confirm a higher number, or they don't want to sort of throw out new statistics before they know more? I mean, because that, even by their standards, that disparity is like, I mean, that's like a Gaddafi statistic.
Yeah, no, they are working with George Washington University to put together a more scientific count. The count that they currently have reflects the fact that I believe local law requires the medical examiners from the government in San Juan to examine each individual body to determine whether it was whether the person died as a result of the storm, and logistically that's been very difficult to do.
Okay, so let's talk about this Harvard study. How did they go about it, and, you know, how did they sort of arrive to that number?
Right, so they just took a more macro approach and looked at, they surveyed, like, I believe, 30,000 Puerto Rican households and sort of asked whether there were deaths in the family and whatnot, and then used, selected them randomly, you know, adjusted for population, and then compared the counts they arrived at to the death toll in 2016 over the same 3 months, and basically found that, nearly 5,000 more people died between September and December in 2017 in Puerto Rico than did in 2016. And, you know, you wonder why that is. Well, it's almost certainly because you had a hurricane wipe out electricity and leave many hospitals without any power for long stretches of time, no cell service across large stretches of the island, and you have a population that is disproportionately elderly, and the elderly are disproportionately impoverished, and you have a recipe for mass death.
And let's just re-review, you know, you end, you, I'll just quote you briefly, and I'd like you to elaborate on the federal government had time to deploy satellite phones to the island to avoid communications blackout, which you just mentioned, that isolated remote areas from the territory's government. It could have delivered reserves of food, fuel, and water in advance of the storm. All of these failings. I mean, I would like maybe just like a kind of re-review and a reminder. You know, in the context of this administration, where it's just the sort of daily atrocities and failures and every sort of human grotesqueness, you know, this is the type of thing that people sort of forget about. But I mean, first of all, it is actually in the United States, and it reflects this, you know, broad colonial extractive history of Puerto Rico. So maybe just, you know, re-review what really should be, in many respects, you know, their Katrina.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as you alluded to, do I think that if Trump did everything right, that there wouldn't have been mass deaths from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? Probably not. You know, I think that as you suggested, we've already, you know, bear a great deal of responsibility for the real economic ruination of the island, and the fiscal issues that the island had resulted in having an electrical grid that was not prepared to handle a storm that was very likely going to come at some point. So, and you know, arguably the Obama administration, all past administrations bear some responsibility for those underlying conditions. But could Trump have done much more than he did? Obviously. They had advance notice of the storm. They did nothing to prepare for it. He went on a four-day golf vacation after it made landfall. They did almost nothing after that. They distributed resources, emergency federal resources. They gave more to Texas, even though Texas was dealing with a less severe emergency after Harvey than they did to Puerto Rico. And, you know, the most gratuitous things about the Trump administration is the way that the president added insult to injury, you know, by feuding with the mayor of San Juan, right, over Twitter, going to Puerto Rico and saying how, you know, they should be like happy that this is not a real tragedy like Katrina.
Throwing, you know, paper towels at people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, very sort of giving, like, just, you know, in some ways, maybe this is what Trump is useful for, like, you know, making the way that our country fundamentally views this category of its citizens as unequal and less human, making it really sort of visible, not just in policy, but in rhetoric. But yeah, so I think that, you know, I think that Trump's inadequate response killed people. I think that probably the longer history of America's extractive relationship with Puerto Rico probably killed more, or probably did more to facilitate the destruction that Maria wrought.
Absolutely. All right. Let's just one more piece I want to touch on with you. You just released Purdue Pharma knew its opioids were widely abused by the late 90s. And it's just, I love, you know, just even the historical sweep of taking us back, you know, I mean, not that long ago, but certainly well before there was this sort of national understanding that this is a major crisis. You already had corporate malfeasance about this looming public health problem.
Yeah, I mean, there was corporate malfeasance from the very beginning. So, right, you know, obviously we've had opioids and we've had opioid addicts for a long, long time in the United States. But in the mid-1990s, Purdue Pharma, it wanted to make a lot of money off the opioids market, and it needed to solve two problems. One, you know, most of these opioid drugs, like, they've been around forever, they're available generically. And two, doctors have this belief that opioids are very addictive and you don't want to prescribe them, you know, too loosely, and especially not for long-term use. And so they tried to solve both these problems at once with OxyContin, which is a patented they made a slow release formula, and they were able to patent that, and they then subsequently argued that because this is extended release, it actually isn't appealing to drug addicts who want a big hit right away immediately, and so this is not, it can't be abused. The FDA did not actually approve that claim. What it did approve was that there is, you know, some reason to believe that this might be slightly less addictive or less appealing to drug abusers than Vicodin. But they took that FDA claim, mealy-mouth FDA claim, and advertised that this was actually safe for chronic long-term use. What was quickly apparent was that this idea made no sense, that to make an extended-release opiate, you need to concentrate more drug into a smaller pill or into a smaller space, and so you can get a... And so if, you know, an opioid addict crushes the pill and snorts it, it's actually much more appealing to drug abusers than any of its competitors. And almost immediately, you had this explosion in its presence on the streets, pharmacies being robbed for it, and an immediate demand for it. And the Purdue Pharma's executives were alerted to this phenomenon, both through academic studies and anecdotal reports, almost immediately after its release. They claimed in testimony before Congress a decade later that they didn't know about their drug's potential for abuse, for widespread abuse, until the early 2000s. And the Justice Department ultimately did make a settlement with Purdue Pharma in which they got them on the misbranding charge, so on the misrepresenting the FDA's claims about what their drug could do. But the Justice Department investigators wanted to pursue felony charges against three Purdue Pharma executives for conspiracy to defraud the United States. And their political higher-ups appointed by George W. Bush, the George W. Bush administration's Justice Department heads, vetoed that idea and helped facilitate this fine, which was ultimately a fraction of what Purdue Pharma made off of this scheme.
As a final question, would you say that an anecdote or an example rather like this is illustrative of the fact that while it has been accelerated by Trump, that our whole modern political, economic, judicial experience is one of a, you know, either a deep erosion of norms or the use of norms in the service of basically just sort of rank corporate and economic abuse, that this has a much longer history in our present moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is this false dichotomy between, you know, the idea of, oh, is our problem rule of law or is our problem economic? Is our primary problem, you know, rule of law or primary problem economic inequality? And I think cases like Purdue Pharma's makes it fairly clear that fundamentally there's a certain level of disparity in economic power that makes it makes the rule of law into a joke, that you have a situation where our government says that, you know, drugs are this evil, so evil, that a first-time crack, a first-time offense for dealing crack can land somebody in jail for life, but that a corporation that organizes the worst drug epidemic in American history that kills, you know, 40,000 to 60,000 people a year, that they, you know, get a little talking to. I think, you know, illustrates the fact that, that we really, we can't have a society that actually runs on laws and not run by men unless there is some kind of equalization in economic power.
Eric Levitz, he's a political writer from the New York Magazine Intelligencer section. Really appreciate your time, yep, as always.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, folks. We're going to go to the fun half, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I will open the IMs shortly. We have more sound. We have more people to make fun of. And the four of us are here. Sam, I don't know. Sam, I wonder what Sam does with his four-day work week.
He's reading Social Security reports, I imagine.
I love it. You're right. You slid right. That routine just kept carrying. He's reading Social Security reports. He's kvetching. What's
taking
on
naps in his Casper bed?
I'm taking a nap in my Casper bed. What's on Antifada this week?
Well, we're a little delayed. Unfortunately, we tried to record an episode on Fire Island over the weekend, and that didn't go very well. But we recorded something last night talking about the Jonathan Chait piece and breaking that down. And we're recording some more today. We're talking about that 30-year-old stay-at-home son as well.
That guy's awesome.
Yeah, I agree. We are in agreement on this. Yeah. And we're actually doing a fun thing for the first time ever. We're taking questions from our listeners. So I think it's going to be a premium thing. So if you want to ask us a question, or maybe it's more of a comment, you can join our show and email us at antifadamindset@gmail.com.
Matt, how do we pronounce her name?
Wait, whose name?
The woman, the brilliant guest we had on Tuesday, who's going to become going to be on the show more.
Mersa Baradaran.
We talked with her about the history of intergenerational wealth collapses, then the and race, but then also the history of correlations of cultural stories between with economic exploitation, from divine providence to social Darwinism to market fundamentalism. Then we talked about postal banking. She's a brilliant guest. There was a segment on abolishing ICE. David Grisham has a new segment for us called the Economic Minute. We talked about this new bank run on Africa, which was fueled through quantitative easing, which is going to seriously hurt the continent, it looks like. And then Felix Biederman was in studio, and we had a lot of fun. And there's a new show, Woke Bros, that Waz and I do exclusively for TMBS and Count the Dings patrons. This Sunday, Douglas Lane and I have done a Marxist terminology primer on core concepts in Marxism. Last week, Bill Fletcher Jr., global Marxism. And next week, Mark Blythe is returning, but this time just for patrons. So that check.
Super good.
It is super good. So patreon.com/TMBS. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate all of you. And of course, you know, become a member of the Majority Report. and there's links to all of these things in the show notes, as well as today's sponsor, and check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. We'll see you in the fun half.